Wessex LMCs, supporting you and your practice.
Hello and welcome to another Wessex LMCs podcast. You're here with me, Dr. Laura Edwards, a GP and co-CEO of Wessex LMCs. And I'm joined today by Dr. Andy Purwick, my fellow co-CEO. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
So Andy and I have dedicated this podcast to going through the new GP contract for you. Again, there have been some headlines out there, but most of you, I expect, will not have had time to drill down into the detail. So we have done this for you, and we're hoping that this is an easy, accessible way of getting that information. So you can listen to this perhaps in some soothing environment, or perhaps a walk through some nice woods whilst you listen to us explain everything that you need to know. So sadly, we are starting off with the central fact that this has actually been imposed. It's very disappointing that after a number of years, we're hoping that the government might realise what a difficult state general practice is in, and therefore might actually collaborate and seek to try and support us and our highly valuable services for our patients. But sadly, that did not happen. So we've had yet again another contract imposition, which is a real shame. So I wanted to ask you, Andy, how does this feel to receive as a GP partner?
Well, I think most of us were hoping for some sort of stepping stone contract, acknowledging that with a general election pending, there weren't going to be massive material changes to the contract, but we at least wanted some sort of security and certainty moving forward to try and stabilise the practices. And my understanding is that this is what the BMA were trying to negotiate on our behalf. There weren't unrealistic demands. It was more about stabilising practices and presenting what the minimum requirement was for practices to feel in a position where that they could carry on delivering safe patient services. So it's slightly ironic that Amanda Doyle starts her letter detailing the contract by saying that general practice is central to the NHS and appreciating our hard work. As a partner and a GP, I'm not really feeling the love with this contract. And to say I'm disappointed is an understatement. I think if we look at the planning assumption of a 2% pay growth for all staff, including our ARS staff, a 1.68% uplift for inflation and a 0.38% population growth, our core GMS funding is not going to be going up anywhere near enough to avoid serious financial pressures for practices moving forwards. I think practices are doubly hit here in that their staff, a number of their staff are going to have to be moved up to the new national minimum living wage. This is also going to have a significant impact on practice finances. And then we are also beholden to the Doctor and Dentist Review Board, which will make recommendations around doctors' pay later in the year. The government aren't obliged to acknowledge or recommend the DDRB uplifts, but they have said that they will leave recommendations to DDRB. So potentially practices may be looking at offering their doctors, their salaried doctors on the BMA model contract more than the 2% uplift. And we all know that the funding in the GMS contract for staff amounts to 44% of the contract. So the headline of a 2% uplift to 44% of the contract, when most practices use way in excess of the 44% of their GMS funding for staffing, again, will be a massive financial pressure for practices.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, our own sort of research into this and other experts out in the field have suggested that really practices are somewhere between 60 and 70% funding on staff. So that leaves you with a gap of maybe 30% out that is just not funded when the government have done their calculations. And that really hurt practices last year. And it seems to they've set us up in a similar fashion this year, which, again, is really disappointing. Okay, so I think you mentioned lots of numbers there, 2%, 1.68%, 0.3%. What's the headline number that's coming out?
2%. And the headline is, it's not enough. I mean, it doesn't keep up with inflation. It doesn't keep up with all the other cost pressures within the practice. And we're also likely to see local enhanced services have a similar pressure in terms of negligible uplift, because as we know, all the ICBs are significantly financially stretched. But I think what we will endeavor to do when we look at the rest of this contract is squeeze out some dregs of positivity.
Yes.
So should we have a look at QoF?
Yes, we will have a look at QoF. So do you want to, let's have a look. We'll say, we've had some news, haven't we, around suspending and income protecting. So they've come out with a really kind of great number. It sounds good. 32 out of 76 QoF indicators are going to be suspended and income protected. Now, again, always, as always, the devil's in the detail. What does that actually mean? What does suspension actually mean? And income protect, what kind of income protection? And when are you income protecting it from? What's your reference point? And we haven't really got that. And again, a number of practices have said to us, we've had some really strange years recently with various world events happening that have meant we haven't had a kind of normal year for some time. So I think there's some nervousness out there of when they're going to income protect it from, what they're going to base it on. And we also don't know yet whether this is kind of a restricting thing or a flaw, a safety flaw. So again, these are unknowns, and we're waiting for some detail. Again, we hope that, of course, they income protect us on a baseline, which allows practices to excel or improve or have a better year. And if they do so, that they would be rewarded for that. But we don't know. That's an unknown. So it's 212 of the 635 points that are available. However, quite a lot of these, so 81 points, are actually from the register indicators. So 19 register indicators have been changed. And we actually would comment that those are essential for your prevalence data and adjustments. So actually, they're quite key that you still keep up to date. Otherwise, you will get penalised for that. So the things that have been actually picked out are the asthma one, with percentage of patients who are on the register who are 19 and under with smoking status recorded, COPD, percentage of patients with an MRC dyspnea scale over 5 in the preceding 12 months referred for pulmonary rehab, which again, a lot of practices we know have just struggled with because there aren't any pulmonary rehab services available. Depression, again, this one we feel is probably just normal practice for most. So sort of helpful, I think, for those practice managers who go around scrabbling to get the people who don't quite manage it in time frames or don't engage. So it'll help from that point of view. But it's a percentage of patients with new depression follow up in 10 to 15, 56 days after diagnosis. Mental health, it's the percentage of patients who've received all six elements of the physical health check on the severe mental illness register, which we were sort of really mixed feelings about that one, because it feels like that potentially will mean the practices take their eye off the ball on that one. It feels like if you're being put on this kind of list, then perhaps you're being encouraged not to prioritize this, which doesn't sit very well with us for that. We're just a bit nervous this will actually increase health inequalities, which doesn't feel great in the current climate. Then we've got cancer care reviews and the percentage of patients in the last 2 years have had a cancer care review and a structured template within 12 months of diagnosis. And then the percentage of patients who've had a discussion and been informed with the primary care support within 3 months of a diagnosis. And lastly, smoking, which is a long list of the different registers, but essentially your chronic disease registers and the percentage of patients who are current smokers who've been offered the smoking cessation support in the last 12 months. Then we've also got some around the QI indicators that have received the same treatment, suspension and income protection. Those are the ones on the workforce and wellbeing, which again, it seems a little sad that kind of feels like it's getting deprioritized, and demand and capacity, which hasn't gone away at all because it's mentioned elsewhere. So again, it's sort of, they're going, but they're sort of not really going, really. That's where we're at with those. In terms of payments, we know cash flow is actually becoming quite an issue for a number of practices. I think to help with that, they've increased aspiration payments to 80%. So again, that's a kind of double-edged sword in that you will get the money, but obviously if you don't get the achievement, then you'll get a clawback that you might not have been expecting. So practices need to be aware of that and kind of watching out for that during the year, measuring their performance so they don't get a clawback that they weren't anticipating that causes them further problems. And then there's been a change to the indicator around the cholesterol lipid management that is there to align the new NICE guidance. So let's move on to digital telephony. Andy, did you want to come in?
Yeah, just before the digital telephony, it's also important to remember that even though, irrespective of which year they choose to protect payments against, that amount may still be subject to, or will still be subject to adjustment in terms of QOF earnings due to prevalence adjustments and list size variation. So you can't guarantee your income based on previous years, because it's still dependent on your prevalence and your list size.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we move on to digital telephony, I think this is an issue in some areas. We've had a lot of practices moving over to telephony. Practices have been able to procure through the national framework, but not all practices have been able to do it equitably across all ICBs. And I think we're hearing that some ICBs are financially challenged now and are withdrawing financial support for digital telephony. But very much part of this contract, practices are going to be obliged to provide data on 8 metrics for use by PCNCDs, ICBs and NHS England from October 24. And that's around call volume, calls abandoned, time to answer, missed calls, wait time before abandoned, callback requests, callbacks made, and the average call length. The assurances we've been given is that the data will be used in a supportive way to look at patient demand and access. But obviously, the cynics of us out there are worried that it may be used as a stick to beat us.
Yeah. Okay. And did you want to tell us about the performers list and any changes that have been made there?
Yeah. So the introductions that were brought in during COVID have been made permanent. So that's where doctors that are employed or registered with bodies that are designated by the Medical Profession Regulations 2010, they'll be able to deliver primary care services without being on the medical performers list. So effectively, doctors working predominantly in secondary care will be able to come out and work in general practice, but with the caveat that they can't see undifferentiated patients. So some may see this as a positive, others may see this as a potential threat, especially for salaried doctors, where we're already hearing there are issues with finding job vacancies because a lot of practices are finding they're financially challenged, and with funding only coming into the PCNs for ARS roles, ARS staff are being prioritised over doctor staff.
There's one to watch, really, that I think that felt like one that's kind of got more to it than we necessarily understand at this point. So I think, yeah, there's one that's, we're going to feel some national direction, I have no doubt around that. And I think it's, yeah, one to watch, I feel, with that one.
Okay. Taking a slight positive though, it may be potentially a way of getting more secondary care expertise out into the community and having more integrated, joined up working.
Exactly. Again, I feel like this is one where we need to have the conversations around it of what are they intending to come from this, and then how can we use that to best effect in primary care, not as a threat, but as an opportunity to get what we actually need in general practice. So, one to unpack, I think, a little bit more as more detail comes out. So then we move on to registration and registering with the GP. Again, some practices are already on this, and there's an online registration service. And actually, we've heard, relatively good feedback. Practices have been happy with this. But there's now a bit of forcing going on, a bit of stick going on here, that this is going to have to be something that practices offer alongside a new paper form. So, it will be interesting to see how fast that comes in and how that feels for practices. I think it's always disappointing when things have to be kind of forced in, but as we said, hopefully it will not be too negative. Again, we've heard that relatively good feedback from practices, so just a shame that they're having to force it in, really. Moves on to continuity of care, which is something that, again, as a profession we highly value. And it's, again, just how that is brought in a manageable, sustainable way. And again, they've said here that they're going to change the regulations to explicitly require continuity of care to be considered when determining the appropriate response when a patient contacts their practice. So again, that's the wording, and we need to be really clear about the wording when we're actually thinking about how this actually works in reality. Again, I think that's going to take a little bit of time, a little bit of conversations of what does that actually practically mean. It feels like a departure away from the total obsession with access, which I think you and I have lamented a number of times, that actually that just seems to kind of produce a revolving door scenario where patients are kind of in, technically seen, and then back out without really getting that proper quality consultation, because just totally focused on the being seen as quickly as possible, which we think is the wrong measure. So this move towards continuity, acknowledgement of that is helpful, and we'll see it crop up a little bit later in terms of the capacity and access payment and some changes there. Okay, over to you, Andy. Any thoughts or comments?
Yeah, just that there's that slight conflict, isn't there, as you say, with the obsession with access and then continuity of care. And there's some contradictions within the contract as well, where we look at, as you say, the capacity and access payments, and we'll touch on those in a bit. I think if we move on to vaccinations and immunizations.
Absolutely. So again, we are getting payments. It's a little bit frustrating. There's no uplift there. So they stay at £10.06. And there are some requirements here about sharing and recording information that are there, including submitting the workforce information quarterly to the National Workforce Reporting Service. And then there's also been something slipped in around using the NHS digital tool to reproduce a digital copy of your practice boundary. And then again, in a kind of other thing, they've popped in about having due regard for armed force veterans, which doesn't say a lot in of itself. Again, our interpretation of that will be increasing awareness and recognition of the covenant. We've done some previous work about this, haven't we, as an OMC? We know a number of practices have been really active and proactive around this within our area, which has been absolutely fantastic. But for those people who are sitting there going, the Armed Forces Covenant, I've not heard that before. Andy, do you want to just explain that to us a little?
Yeah, I think as an LMC, we've always been very supportive of veteran friendly practice schemes, and the Armed Forces Covenant forms part of that, where our servicemen who are either active servicemen or who have been in the service of the Armed Forces are entitled to prioritisation within the NHS. We're asked to identify those servicemen or women when we are referring into secondary care in particular, so that they can be prioritised as necessary. And I think there are increasing resources out there for ex-servicemen and women. And I think it's really important that we identify those individuals so that they can access those additional services in a timely manner.
Yeah, absolutely. So and we'll pop a link in about the Armed Force Covenant, something there, just so if people haven't heard of that, that you can look at that on our kind of blurb that goes with the podcast. So that brings us on to the network contractors. Again, they've offered some offers here, which again, you have to kind of look at and think, are these good? Are these not good? And again, I think there's some thought to be had to maximise what's best for you. So they've talked about some increased flexibility, particularly enhanced practice nurses will now be eligible. Again, you need to kind of look at that before. I think the murmurings before it came out was practice nurses are in. It's not quite the same as practice nurses are in. You actually, before you claim and then find out that you're not eligible, you need to really carefully read the guidance around this and check that your nurse actually meets these criteria. So it's postgraduate certification or diploma in a specialist area. And I think there's been a level ascribed to that, which is something like level 7. I'm looking on the top of my
correct.
Head, but correct. So make sure that you're really clear on that before allocating somebody into that. And rather disappointingly, there's only one per PCM for this, because actually otherwise I think this would be something that practices could use quite a lot.
Unless your PCN is over 100,000 population, in which case you can have two.
Absolutely. So that's helpful. But we always get nervous about more and more things going into IRS because of that kind of control over wages that can happen there, which then goes out of practice control. So always a bit of a double-edged sword there. Then there is something around those with additional mental health practitioners. Again, the PCN can now choose to sort of the amount that they would like to contribute towards the funding. So the first mental health practitioner you get has to be 50-50 with the Mental Health Trust. But the ones after that, you can actually, if the Mental Health Trust turns around and says, we can't afford anymore, you can actually choose to top that up all the way up to 100%. But they still need to be employed by the Mental Health Trust in that work. They've removed the caps on the advanced practitioners, which is sort of helpful. We'll go with helpful. The PCN will now get reimbursed for time for personalised care roles out of practice training. The big thing is that the ICB are no longer able to redistribute unclaimed ARS funding between the PCNs. Over to you, Andy. Any comments or thoughts?
Yeah, just one other thing that they slipped in was that other direct patient care, so non-nurse, non-doctor roles, can be employed, but with ICB agreement if there is funding available.
Do we know what that kind of means?
I would assume that you're talking about your social prescribers. So they have direct patient care, but they're non-clinical.
Okay. It's always funny, isn't it, when you define something as a non-this, non-that. So it's kind of, it's sometimes helpful just to have the examples. So that's one that's positive there, hopefully. So that takes us on to the capacity and access payment.
Yeah, so this payment continues. As we know, 70% is paid without reporting requirements, which is a positive thing, and that's called the capacity and access support payment. And then we have 30% available via the capacity and access improvement payment, and that has three components with a 10%, a third payment on each area. So you have area one with better digital telephony, area two, simpler online requests, and area three, faster care navigation and assessment and response. If we go to area two, there's a little bit that's been slipped in there saying that online consultations must be available for patients to make admin and clinical requests, at least for the duration of core hours. I think for a lot of practices, that again, just signals the removal of a potential safety net and capping of workload, potentially unleashing unlimited workload coming in. Many of us will switch off online access when we have reached capacity or safe working levels. And similarly, in area three, faster care navigation, assessment and response includes asking patients' preference to wait for a preferred clinician. So this does tie in a little bit with continuity of care, but I still feel there's a slight conflict there with sort of prioritizing faster access.
So again, we would just signal you as an LMC to think about these. Don't just chase the targets because they exist. Actually make a considered business decision of whether this is the right thing for you. Does the resource, does the reward actually recognize the amount of work that you will need to do? So looking at that, particularly that second one around the online consultations, you need to make a PCN decision, have conversations of, is this something you want to chase? Or actually, is having control over the times that you're open, does that actually mean that you can be much more effective and that your roles and your practice is more sustainable? Because there is only 10% of the capacity and access fund, capacity and access payment funding allocated to that, and that's the maximum. So just have a think. We just say, step back with some of these things, make a considered decision before just saying, oh, that's what they've set us, that's what we must do. So that takes us on to the Investment and Impact Fund, another fund. Again, our income streams are never simple, are they? So, Andy, do you want to tell us what they've done with that?
Yeah, so this is a positive reduction in indicators from 5 to 2 indicators. They're retaining the learning disability health checks and fit testing. And I think most of us would agree with those two indicators as being positive indicators. And the funding from the other three indicators is going to be redirected back into the unconditional capacity access support payment. So again, that's a degree of positivity that I see. I'm trying to remain entirely positive.
You always do, Andy. You always do. So that moves us on to some more rays of sunshine at the PCMCD role. So again, they promised us this is simplified and refocused. So now all you have to do is coordinate service delivery, allocate resources, support transformation towards modern general practice, and support the PCN role in integrated neighbourhood teams. It does feel somewhat like some of those are quite large, so it's only sorting out world peace, world hunger, and making sure that everyone has a happy Christmas every year. I think it can be, you know, you can write things very simply, but they do rely quite large things behind them. So we should never underestimate how challenging a role that can be. There has been as well a change to how the funding is working. So the CD pane at the PCN leadership and the management funding are now all rolled into the core PCN funding. So there has been a change there. Then that moves us on to the network contract data requirements, where again they've promised to simplify, and again we're just sort of waiting really to see how that actually works. So they've talked to this promise of simplification just into one overarching specification with greater focus on outcomes, and it talks about supporting resilience and care delivery, improving health outcomes, reducing health inequalities, and delivering proactive care. So it does feel like one of those challenges where they say, can you just do one sentence? And then they've written a side of A4 as the one sentence, really. Again, there's some quite big asks in this simplified and overarching specification. But we're going to remain optimistic, aren't we, Andy, that actually it will be something that is entirely manageable within primary care's remit and not at all to do with the entire wider determinants of health, although I've actually heard that described now as the core determinants of health, really, that we should be calling them rather than wider determinants of health, which we cannot influence as primary care. And then last but not least, the enhanced access specification remains unchanged. So that brings us to the end. And I think, oh, there's one last bit of the weight management, which is remaining at £11.50 per referral, just to slip in there. So Andy, any last comments or thoughts?
Yeah, so if we take the funding issue aside, I think most of us realised that the budgets were tight. I think we did hope that there would be slightly more than a 2% uplift. But the pledge to cut bureaucracy really was what a lot of us were hoping for. And I don't see a massive amount of bureaucracy or workload cut for me in this contract. There are some headlines that look potentially attractive, but when you drill down to the nitty gritty, it's not going to impact my daily workload as a GP. I think that's as great a disappointment to me as the funding. And I think practices will be sitting back and saying, right, okay, what will we stop delivering? And we are going to push back on all unresourced work and unresourced workload transfer. We're going to have to look very hard at all of the locally enhanced services to see whether or not the funding makes business sense for us to continue delivering these. And I think there are going to be very difficult questions around staffing, mindful that the biggest cost to all practices is their staffing budget. And I think practices will be looking at their staffing and saying, right, okay, how can we minimize expenditure and maintain business continuity? And inevitably, if you look at the funding that's coming into practices, that's through ARS staff, and there's very little funding coming in to allow employment of additional doctors. My concern is that you'll see a reduction in the number of GPs within your practices if this direction of travel carries on in terms of the funding of practices.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think recapping, you know, some of the major pressures that we spotted there are the national living wage coming, and that will put real pressure. And I think we're already beginning to see practices and PCNs beginning to recalculate what they can actually afford with the funding that they've been given. And this is a national decision about what they've been given, and we're going to have to cut our cloth accordingly. But it does feel perverse that at a time where actually all the direction of travel and all the noise nationally is about preventative care everything being in primary care, that actually we are stuck with around 7% of the budget, and actually this is an underinflation lift, and therefore it's a cut, and we are actually seeing practices having to take that out in reality, which maybe they have to reconsider what staffing, as you said, that they can actually afford. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, if we were in bigger, shinier businesses, we might call in management consultants at this point and get them to advise us what to do. And I'm sure that what they would say is, look at your contracts and what's in your contracts. What do you actually need to do? What are you getting resource for? And what isn't in your contract to do? And if you're doing it anyway, you're effectively doing some charity work, which may be very nice to do, but actually, can you actually afford to do it as a business? Because you're being asked to act as a business. You're not being funded in a charitable way here. You are being asked to act as a business. You have to make your books balance. So you need to look, and where you've been asked to do things nicely by the system, if they're not resourcing you to do it, then actually you need to just be focusing on what you are paid and resourced to do. So I think we've been looking at shared care, particularly as an OMC, and we've given you some guidance around that. That is an ask from secondary care, and it is about shared care, but ultimately it's a voluntary thing. Unless you're in an LCS, you do need to look again. If you're in a contract, you need to look at it. But if it's not included under an LCS, then actually this is something you're voluntarily taking on. And it may be that you and your practice, your PCN, and we would encourage you to work together to make these decisions, actually aren't in a position to take on that work, in which case it isn't your problem. Again, this is said in really difficult thing to say, because the patients come to us, but actually, we cannot continue to take all of this. We actually need the system to help us and provide good care for the patients. But we cannot continue to take everything if we're not resourced to do it. Andy?
The system has relied on goodwill from practices filling commissioning gaps.
Yeah.
But goodwill doesn't run a practice.
No.
You can't fund a practice on goodwill. And we need realistic investment moving forward if we're going to maintain and develop sustainable general practice for our patients moving forward.
Absolutely. And we, as your local LMC, will be having conversations with ICBs. Those LCSs are more vital than ever, and need to be resourced appropriately, and need to take into account the National Living Wage and all of these pressures that will be falling to practices. So we will be pushing for those. And again, if you want to share information with us about how this is impacting your practice, we do welcome that, so that we can escalate that. Again, it can be done anonymously through us, but real case examples of how these changes are affecting you is really helpful for us to be aware of as your local representative body. So thank you ever so much for listening to this podcast. We hope you found it helpful, and we will continue to keep you informed as the changes become clearer and we get more detail. Thank you again for all of the hard work that you are doing every day for your practice and for your patients. And we wish you a good week. Thank you very much. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Wessex LMCs, supporting you and your practice.